From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're monitoring the situation in Puerto Rico, which is dealing with the aftermath of the worst hurricane it has faced in a century. In Mexico City today, an army of volunteers is racing to find survivors buried in rubble after Tuesday's magnitude 7.1 earthquake. The death toll is already in the hundreds. Jorge Valencia is a reporter with KJZZ in Mexico City. Jorge, the whole country is watching that school where more than 20 children died. There are more missing, including one who authorities now know is alive. They're trying to save. What can you tell us?
Well, the reports that we've gotten coming out of the school say that this is a little girl whose name is Frida Sofia. They say that rescuers actually yesterday called out and to see if there were any signs of life. They believe that there was a girl there and that they saw her fingers wiggling. Now, the thing with this situation is that some of the reports are conflicting about what is actually happening there. But at least if what we're getting is correct, I mean, she certainly is emblematic of the overall hope of the rescue operations at that school and at the many other places where there are still people being dug out.
Yeah, hopefully they will be able to bring her out alive, because so many other children obviously were not able to be brought out alive. You've been traveling around the city. What have you seen? What's the extent of the destruction?
Well, in this city, I have seen several buildings firsthand, just traveling mostly on foot, trying not to contribute to the congestion in the city. Like many people are trying to allow emergency vehicles to travel freely in a city that's usually very congested. The city has confirmed 38 buildings, many of them mid-rise apartment buildings. And then also outside of the city, we've had a couple of dozen more. And so certainly there's been bad news and there's been good news. The bad news is that unfortunately and not surprisingly, the death toll has continued to come up. But at the same time, we've gotten good news that more than 50 people have been rescued from different places in Mexico City and in surrounding areas.
What about the infrastructure? You talked about the buildings that have collapsed. What about the roads? Are they operational?
Yeah, at least in Mexico City, things have somewhat resumed to a normalcy. The metro system, the metro bus system has, according to authorities, come back to almost full capacity. And in fact, it has been running free of charge. And so the areas that have been cordoned off are just areas, specific areas where buildings have come down.
Jorge, as you know, I was down in Mexico City in April to do the show from there. And while I was there, I visited a neighborhood called Ecatepec, which is kind of a slum neighborhood near Mexico City. And it was just filled with these very poorly constructed houses in the hills. I wonder how the poorer neighborhoods of Mexico City have survived this earthquake.
Well, in Ecatepec in particular, which is a borough north of Mexico City, like you said, it is largely very low income. We don't have any major reports of damage there, which is great news. Fortunately, Mexico State, which surrounds the city, was one of the areas that was the least impacted. But if we move farther out, south of Mexico City, there's a town called Cojutla, where there were a few dozen buildings that came down, including the town hall. So unfortunately, as these things happen with natural disasters, some of the communities that were perhaps already in trouble before it happened are sometimes the communities that suffer the most.
There is a strange anniversary that we've talked about here, which is that this earthquake occurred on the anniversary, the 32nd anniversary of an earthquake in Mexico that killed 10,000 people back in 1985. Are people talking about that? Have you met anyone who lived through both?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's been a range in reactions. Some people have been rather calm about it. I met a woman who was here for an earthquake in 1957 that was rather strong. It toppled a very famous monument in the city. That's an Angel of Independence. She was here in 1985. She was here, of course, this week. She's been living in the same neighborhood. She's been experiencing it in the same place. And she took it rather calmly, saying, well, you know, this is simply the earth rearranging itself. And, you know, all that we can do is pray to God that he'll protect us. There's been that kind of response. But there's also been people that have been a little bit more frantic about it. I met a family yesterday whose home was still in place. But they said, listen, we don't think that it's a coincidence that it was exactly 32 years later to the date that this earthquake happened. So there's a range of emotions in response to this. And I think that the overarching reality, at least that we can say fact-wise, is that earthquakes here have been happening for millennia. Pre-Hispanic communities had their own seismic warning systems, and they are going to continue to happen. So the question is, how can the city prepare? How can the country prepare? Certainly, there were a lot of lessons after 1985. There were new rules that were put in place. But I think that after this, we've got hundreds of people that died. And I think that hopefully, I think that there probably will be many questions that will be answered about how can we better prepare for this going forward.
That's Jorge Valencia, a reporter with KJZZ, joining us from Mexico City. Jorge, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we'll check in hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico later, but Houston is still dealing with Harvey. Now, Houston was a fairly affordable real estate hotbed. Yesterday, we heard that home sales nationwide would take a hit because of weather, but maybe not in Houston. Shally Ralph is president of Heritage Texas Properties. And Shally, we're reading that homeowners selling when Harvey hit thought surely they wouldn't sell, but they are?
Well, I think you have investors coming in, and you also have people who are still very strong on the Houston market. Houston is very affordable, and there's still quite a bit of inventory in the Houston market that wasn't affected as well.
What else is happening with the housing there? Because, yes, people still smell Houston as a hot place to be, so they might be gobbling up these homes even if they're flooded. But what if they're unlivable? Isn't that kind of reducing the number of homes available?
Well, I think what most people need to realize is that some people just got back into their homes within the last week. So decisions have to be made. People need to look at it. Their insurance adjusters need to get into the homes. And people will have to make decisions whether they rebuild and move back into them or whether they, you know, tear down and build new.
Or sell.
Or sell. Yeah. Or sell it as is. Correct.
And what are you hearing?
I think we're hearing a combination. It depends on the area. I mean, some people have flooded previously and feel that they don't want to go through that again. But we have many areas in the Houston market that for the first time ever flooded.
Yeah. Well, we're reading that agents are already seeing homes jump in price. Here's one. It's anecdotal, but an agent named Gina Turner said a 3-bedroom ranch in Willow Bend jumped by $82,000 just a few days after Harvey hit.
And I would have to, I'm not familiar with that particular listing, but I would say, did it jump in price and then pinned it and then sold? Or did it just go on the market at a higher price? The real estate market is always really controlled by supply and demand. If there is little supply in an area, prices may go up. But I think the main thing is that a buyer and seller should consult with a realtor and understand the true market where they live. Because, I mean, the market changes by neighborhood and sometimes by parts of a neighborhood.
Yeah. What about rentals?
Rentals obviously have been strong because of the immediate need for people to access even short-term living. One of the things that the Houston Association of Realtors did is we placed, added a site on our website at har.com to allow people to find anywhere from, you know, just a couple of days rental or all the way up to 12 weeks of rental to try to accommodate the consumer and really help them in the process over the next couple of months.
Well, one of the reasons that people are finding that their homes are still desirable even if there's been flooding is, and we've reported on this before, the Houston metropolitan area adds 400 people a day and
Correct.
Builds 40,000 housing units a year. One of the criticisms is that Houston is too developed. It's too paved over. And yeah, there's plenty of housing, but at what cost when there's no place for water to go? Are real estate agents like you concerned about this or talking about this?
Well, I think obviously, Harvey was a disaster for us. And so, I mean, yes, we are talking about it. In our own offices, we had an appraiser, a mortgage broker, and an insurance agent in our office yesterday, just talking to our agents about, you know, how we can assist our buyers and sellers. Obviously, our expertise is buying and selling homes, not making the decisions for them. And it is a personal decision. I mean, whether someone buys or whether someone stays in a home that's been flooded, it's not a decision that we can make for them. They need to make that on their own.
I'm wondering if you're wondering if the boom is over.
I don't think so. I mean, we've had a good, strong market. I'm not sure I would even call it a boom. It's been mostly a seller's market. In the last couple of months, it's shifted more into, you know, possibly buyer-seller's market. Again, real estate is local and local to a neighborhood. So, I mean, you have some markets that have become a buyer's market prior to the storm.
Do you expect to have what happened in New Orleans after Katrina, which is that so many people came to help, they ended up staying and becoming part of the housing market, you know, buying homes?
Well, I think you will see some of that. We have a close contact in New Orleans, Gardner Realtors, and we've been, you know, speaking with them quite a bit about their experience after Katrina, because they've experienced what we're going through right now. You know, obviously, everybody needs to step back, take a breath, really try to absorb what's happened to us, but then, you know, really kind of put one foot in front of the other and move forward. I mean, their market came back strong, and some of the areas that were completely destroyed are top markets now in the New Orleans area.
Shally Ralph, president of Heritage Texas Properties, thank you so much.
Thank you.
World leaders are meeting this week in New York at the United Nations General Assembly. President Trump's schedule today includes meetings with the presidents of Turkey, Afghanistan, Ukraine, and South Korea, and the Prime Minister of Japan. Russian President Vladimir Putin is not attending this year, in part because he's been watching large-scale Russian military exercises being carried out near the borders with the Baltics, increasing tension in the region. We're joined now from New York by the President of Latvia, Raimonds Vejonis. Mr. President, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
And what is the biggest issue for you as you come to the United Nations General Assembly in New York? What's the most important issue on your plate?
Of course, during the UN General Assembly, for me, the most important issue is to talk with state leaders about security, because we have very unpredictable neighbor, Russia, and at present moment, Russia had already has exercise, military exercise near our borders, and of course we have fears about this exercise.
Do you see them as a threat?
Probably no, because we already done a lot of. First of all, we invest in our national army, and for example, next year we will reach 2% of GDP what we invest in our army, in security. And secondly, we have very good friends within NATO and, for example, US, or we have at present moment in our country Canada-led enforced presence forces in our country. And of course, this presence gives a very strong signal to our society and also to our neighbors that we are not alone. We are together with our friends, with our allies, and we are ready for any possible scenario if anybody would like to make any threat to our country or threat to NATO to react on these threats.
Do you think President Putin in Russia would try to invade another country?
We have examples. In 2008, Russia invaded in Georgia, in 2014 in Crimea and Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine. And of course, we have these examples, and it is the reason why we have these fears, but in the same time, as I said, we are ready for any scenario, even against military aggression.
Do you think that you have an ally in President Trump on the issue of Russia? Because he's obviously been criticized for being too cozy with Putin.
We have very good relations and partnership with U.S. And also with Mr. Trump. And during his last meetings, what we had, for example, in Warsaw, he very clearly announced that U.S. is ready to fulfill all obligations what U.S. have within NATO, and of course the paragraph number 5 of treaty is very important for U.S. It means we received this important signal from Trump that U.S. is ready support us.
As you know, there is an ongoing investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. There's a lot of concern about what Russian hackers did and fake news. Is that something, just the military things aside, is that something you're worried about in Latvia, that Russia is going to try to launch an information war against you?
Yes, of course. We spoke just now about military aggression, but of course, the possibilities for military aggression is very, very low. But in the same time, we every day have maybe problems with cyber attacks, with informational warfare, and of course, we know very well what it means. But in the same time, of course, we are preparing ourselves for. We prepare countermeasures against these attacks.
Before you were president of Latvia, you served as the environment minister there. What do you think of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement?
Paris Agreement is very important for all countries, also for U.S. And, of course, it's very pity that U.S. at present moment is thinking what to do go out of Paris Agreement or stay in Paris Agreement, but I think each country must be a member of this agreement and really fulfill in real life all necessary measures in own national countries, because anyway, we are responsible for our societies, and of course we are responsible for protection of our nature. And U.S. must be in Paris Agreement.
Do you think there's a chance that the U.S. will stay in, even though President Trump has said he's withdrawing?
It's difficult to say. We'll see how it will develop. And of course, yesterday also, Mr. Trump didn't mention Paris Agreement in his speech. Of course, it is for us a little bit pity that he's not speaking about Paris Agreement, about climate changes. But anyway, I hope that U.S. as a country will be ready to continue to be a part of Paris Agreement.
Who would you say is the best friend of the country of Latvia? Which country is the best friend?
The best friends in different region, different friends. So for example, if we speak about transatlantic cooperation, of course, our strategic partners are U.S. and Canada. If we speak about Europe, it's first of all Germany. Hmm. And of course, good friends are our neighbors, Lithuania, Estonia, and of course, Nordic countries, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and Denmark.
And, of course, Europe is going through some big changes right now. We know there's an election coming up this weekend in Germany, but also Brexit, the British leaving the EU. Do you feel like Europe is a strong partner for you or is getting stronger, or do you think Europe is getting weaker right now on the global stage?
Of course, Europe have different challenges at present moment, but I am sure that Europe is still strong to manage these challenges, to be united, because if Europe will be united, Europe always will be very strong. And it means we must be united, and we are united.
That's Raimond Vejonis, who is the president of the nation of Latvia. Thank you so much, Mr. President, for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Let's step back from today's news and remember, or maybe learn for the first time, about something that happened 75 years ago this week. In 1942, during the Second World War, the federal government quietly took over 60,000 acres of farmland in the ridges of East Tennessee. Officials told residents to leave, then built a city cloaked in secrecy for tens of thousands of people. Emily Siner from member station WPLN has the story of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the city that helped build the world's first atomic bomb.
There are a number of theories about why Oak Ridge was chosen to be part of the Manhattan Project. Historians say it didn't hurt that the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee at the time was a Tennessean. It was also very rural, ideal for a project that needed to be kept top secret. So on September 19, 1942, the head of the Manhattan Project selected this land to buy, which did not thrill the area's residents. In an oral history from 2012, a man named Lester Fox recalls the fall day when he and a friend were skipping class after lunch. As they were ambling back, the town's telephone operator ran out and told them to go find the principal.
Go get Mr. Britton an important phone call from Washington, D.C.
After the call, Fox says, the principal organized a school-wide assembly.
And he told us that the federal government had condemned 50-some thousand acres of land, turned out school early so people could go home and tell their parents.
We got a form letter in the mail stating that the property was taken over.
Another resident, Naomi Brummett, says her mother was given just $900 for 40 acres.
And we were supposed to be out of this area by December 31st, 1942.
No one was told why they had to move, except that it was for the war effort. That was the same mindset that tens of thousands of newcomers to Oak Ridge had when they moved in. Brummett was among them. She returned to the area to live in the newly created city and work on a machine that enriched uranium. But like most of her coworkers, she didn't understand the bigger picture.
If we had known, we couldn't speak about it because they had signs everywhere with don't talk. You don't talk. And if you did talk, you weren't there the next day.
It wasn't until the atomic bomb dropped in 1945 that employees realized they had been building the most powerful weapon the world had ever seen. To this day, Oak Ridge retains its nickname as the Secret City and still works with enriched uranium at the Y-12 National Security Complex. But the city has tried to build a legacy less about the bomb and more about the peace that followed. This week, it's breaking ground on a new pavilion for its International Friendship Bell. Oak Ridge's sister city of Nakashi, Japan, recently gave $10,000 for the construction. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Seiner in Nashville.
There was a terrifying moment at Yankee Stadium yesterday.
Look out. Oh, my goodness. That is scary. It was absolutely laced.
A foul ball laced, ripped by the Yankees' Todd Frazier into the stands where it hit a 2-year-old girl in the face. The game was delayed. Players on the field were in tears. The little girl was taken to a hospital. Yankees manager Joe Girardi said he was told by team security that she would be okay. But some of the players are saying, why isn't there more netting? Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. He joins us. And Mike, we've been here before. You know, the Red Sox put up more netting after someone got hit there. It drapes down in front of the seats. It stops the balls. Why doesn't Major League Baseball mandate more netting?
And in Yankee Stadium earlier this year, the issue came up and a local politician introduced legislation. The answer is sight lines. They do have some netting. Everyone who's ever seen a game right behind home plate. But then you have Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, saying in a pretty removed from emotion statement, increased safety netting remains an ongoing discussion in the industry. We gave some guidelines 2 years ago, and we encourage individual clubs to look at their own stadium. So I guess he doesn't want to mandate it, but Brian Dozier of the Twins said every stadium needs to have nets. That's it. I don't care about the damn view of the fan. It's about safety. I still have a knot in my stomach because he saw the little girl. But of course, the view of the fans, for a player to say he doesn't care about the view of the fans, I understand he's emotional in the moment. You do have to weigh that. The thing is, when you have a site like this overtaking the story of baseball, I think a little bit of netting, a little more netting would go a long way.
Right. And others are saying until then, think about, you know, having little kids in that area, because you hit something like that. Dad, in this case, they tried so hard. You don't have a second to stop it.
Yeah, so, you do. And the kids aren't watching and the kids are looking in a different direction. That is absolutely true. I would even say when you sit down, your toddler shouldn't be in the seat closest to home plate.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So we think of her. But meantime, talk about the action on the field. A final 2 weeks of the regular season. Start with the Cleveland Indians. They've won 26 of their last 27 games. Are they the favorites to win the series?
I don't know, but they're so hot. It's not just the winning streak. So the winning streak solidifies our mind and points to this amazing team. But if you extrapolate stats out of the winning streak, what they've done with their starting pitching has been remarkable. And they were not just winning games. If you look at the run differential, you know how much more they scored than their opponents. They were crushing opponents, and they were throwing shutouts, and they were throwing complete game shutouts. If they go into the postseason playing anything like that, yes, they are the big favorites. But of course, as we'll see when we talk about the other best team maybe in baseball, or the team we definitely thought was as good as them, the Los Angeles Dodgers, fortunes change.
Yeah, well, what happened to the Dodgers?
They are the only team in Major League history to have winning streaks where they've won double-digit games and lost double-digit games. They were so good for so long that after the summer, you know, after August, articles were being written, they could lose their next 25 games and still be in first place. Guess what? They lost 20 of their next 25 games. It snuck up on everyone because they're a great team. They had a lot of bad things happen to them at once, and it seems that a couple of their acquisitions actually hurt the team. They've gotten away from that horrid pace in the last few games. But yeah, it's really concerning for a team that was the favorite.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. This is when some people start paying attention to baseball.
Yes.
So Mike, we'll have you back. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's take a moment now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt is a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California. She's back with us once again. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you, and you've got some music for us to get us into fall. And let's get to your first pick, which is New Orleans native Trombone Shorty with Here Come the Girls.
Here come the girls. You're looking so pretty as a dog on pity. Oh, you're looking so fine. I said, look out, brother. Let me get further, look close to the one I love. Anything better than the opposite sex, they must have kept it up above. Here come the girl. Oh, here come the girl.
Now, this is a song that was written in the 70s and originally performed by Ernie K. Doe. Tell us about this version.
Well, it's also written by Alan Toussaint, who's a legend in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Trombone Shorty, I actually interviewed him for Morning Becomes Eclectic at KCRW a couple of weeks ago, and he told me that this song in particular, you know, most people know Ernie K. Doe from Mother-in-Law and stuff like that, and he was really looking for something that was not what was expected from Ernie K. Doe, and he heard the song and he loved it, and he's now playing it and he put it on his album. The album's called Parking Lot Symphony.
And people will be familiar with Trombone Shorty, who grew up in the Treme neighborhood. By the way, as you listen to this, it's like such a New Orleans sound, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. You know, the interesting thing about him, so he picked up the trombone when he was 4 years old. There's a great picture online of Bo Diddley, you know, bending down and talking to him. You know, the trombone's bigger than he is. And by seven, he was in Europe playing festivals. All of his older brothers, you know, are in the Dirty Dozen Brass Band or play with Dr. John or Alan Toussaint. And one thing Trombone Shorty told me that I took away was he felt his responsibility was to move the music forward, that Alan Toussaint said to him before he died, you know, keep doing what you do and put your own stamp in it. Louis Armstrong, you know, Fats Domino listened to Louis Armstrong, the Professor Long here, the Neville Brothers, the Meters. And he just said, keep moving the music forward.
Okay, well, let's move forward with your next pick. This is Noah Slee with his single, Told.
I'm in the middle of the yard. Yeah. I didn't get picked again. I tell myself it's not my fault. You don't know what I have going on. No, you don't. I surprise you with my skills, call me unique, that's not enough. I blame myself cause of religion. Then I spoofed myself with all your views, I did listen. Till I saw my bird's eye view, my perspective. I feel safe and on the unknown. Love is real, now I can say I'm not just clinging on.
Now, Noah Slee is born in New Zealand, based in Berlin. Tell us more about him.
Well, the thing about Noah Slee, whose new album is called Otherland, is that it is so honest. And that song, if you listen to the lyrics closely, he's really revealing his sexuality in these lyrics. And he talks about in that clip not getting picked on the playground. He was uncomfortable. What is he running from? He didn't think his nerves would shake him up this way. He felt that his responsibility was to look inside himself and really share that.
And the song has a very relaxed kind of dance club vibe.
Well, you know, a lot of his songs sound like that. And that is, again, he's talking about some really deep stuff. You know, he's saying that, you know, through writing songs, he found this missing piece of himself. But then the way he presents them, it's one of those great juxtapositions when you have the lyrics sort of saying something pretty intense. And the music, I was just dancing while I was listening to it.
All right. Well, next we've got the British musician Danny Harrison. This is All About Waiting.
So much to remember in the day end. So much to forget when you're afraid. After all the trouble and the breakage, I know all there is to know about.
Now, if this sounds just a little bit familiar to some of our listeners, Danny Harrison is the son of George Harrison, and it's not the Beatles, but it does have, you can hear a little bit of the connection with their voice, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. If you grow up in a household like that, how can it not have that connection? But you know, Danny Harrison wasn't originally a musician. He came to this trade later in life. He was actually working as a car designer for a bit after he graduated from Brown. So he didn't want to release this debut. This is his debut, though he's played with Fistful of Mercy and as part of another group as well. He didn't want to release his debut until he was ready, and he is indeed.
Has he talked about living in the shadow of his father?
Absolutely. People ask him about that all the time, and no doubt that is a challenge. And he also talks about how somehow people who are the kids of famous musicians get it a little harder than people of famous actors or famous politicians or something like that. So I thought that was sort of an interesting observation he made. But what I do want to tell you also is that Danny has spent the last few years really digging himself into film scoring, composition, and he's worked on a bunch of feature films. He's actually currently working on scoring Shepard Fairey's new documentary. And this album, he says, is all about the music he hears in his head, and it has a real cinematic feel to it. The other thing that I think is interesting about this song in particular, All About Waiting, the first time I heard it and the first time I played it on the radio, I thought, oh my gosh, this is ELO. It's like the synths, the whole thing was ELO to me. And I just learned today that Danny Harrison inducted ELO into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Wow. Connections all over the place.
Exactly. I love them.
Okay. Well, the next song that we've got from you is by an artist called Bedouin. And I just want to bring up the fact that when I was in high school, I thought that that word was pronounced Bedouin. I think I had just been in French class for too long, but no, it is Bedouin. And here is Back to You.
California city parks, they talk in exclamation marks. Still dying to know what's exciting. I do a little, don't need a lot. I get with what I got. It may seem brittle, but it's the truth. Always comes back to you.
You're taking it down a notch here and bringing us into a more relaxed atmosphere. But this artist is very interesting.
Yeah, she has an amazing history. She was born in Aleppo, Syria, lived her first 10 years on an American compound in Saudi Arabia, and then her family won the green card lottery. They came to America. She went to college to study sound design, ended up in Los Angeles as a music editor on films, and slowly found her way into poetry and writing music. And the thing that I find so intriguing about her is, for someone with this background, she really embraces, this song sounds to me like dusty California folk. And I hate to even call it folk, because, but she's definitely embraced that sort of West Coast California ethos when it comes to folk music. I hear Nick Drake, I hear Joni Mitchell.
Well, and her sound has been described as 60s folk meets 70s country funk. What about the funk?
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard that. But if you listen to the entire album, that makes absolute sense. You know, she's not confined by any expectations. She's just doing what she wants to do. And she's really writing about what's going on now. And in that song, you know, Walking Around the Streets of Los Angeles, I love this, where everybody speaks in exclamation points. So true. And it's sort of a love, it's mostly a love letter to Los Angeles, I think.
That's Ann Litt, DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Ann, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find us on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
100% of Puerto Rico is without power after Hurricane Maria. Reporter Miguel Santiago of Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico has been our eyes and ears on the ground there. Miguel, you're outside finally taking pictures. You say it's almost apocalyptic?
Right now, we're just a lot of trees have fallen. Not just branches, whole trees have fallen. It's really hard to walk around the University of Puerto Rico's campus. It's undrivable here. Personally, I didn't expect this much damage. Just there was a building here in the campus that it had no walls left.
Wait, a building that has no walls left, like the walls just blown off.
Yeah, exactly.
And Miguel, I can hear that it's still blowing. The wind is still blowing.
Yes, it's very windy right now. I was just walking around the campus. Right now I'm entering the radio station, where I believe it's still rainy also. A little cloudy, but the worst part, at least, it's over.
Yeah. Well, but some would say the worst part is just beginning. Your campus is pretty fortified, strong buildings. What kind of reports are you hearing from the rest of the island?
Some houses' roofs have been blown away. We just lost water here at the radio station. We really didn't expect that, but the whole island also is without water. Out on the street, my boss told me that people are driving on the wrong side of the road because there's so much debris on it.
Yeah. Look, you also told us yesterday you were trying to contact the islands east of Puerto Rico, Viegas and Culebra.
Culebra still hasn't had any communication, but, you know, the whole south, I've been trying to contact relatives, and I haven't had word yet from most relatives. I've only talked to my mother outside here. She works at a veterans hospital. You know, I've been trying to contact my grandmother, and I haven't heard, you know, or feel desperate to just call and see how everyone's doing.
That's going to be hard.
Yeah.
Look, people are talking about a really, really long recovery. I mean, months before power. What are the things that you think of? I know, as you told us, that you're part of a generation that this is the first hurricane you're seeing.
Yeah.
Well, so what are you thinking about?
You know, it's like it's not real. It's hard to tell you because I've never been so much time without electricity. So it'll be like, getting accustomed to a new sort of life.
Well, Felix Delgado, the mayor of the northern coastal city of Caetano, told the AP it will be months and months and months and months before we can recover from this. Puerto Rico's governor said that this is an island destroyed. I mean, when you think further, you know, we've heard of people trapped in their homes with rising water, you know, women going into labor in San Juan in the business district there. But when you talk about no power for months, yes, there are some generators, but you're talking about refrigerators and food and fans. I mean, what are some of the things you start thinking about?
Well, you know, I just lost power. There are people that lost everything. So, this is the type of news that you sort of see around on,
you know, international media, but this is happening right next to me.
Yeah. I mean, and you're Americans. What would you want to tell the Puerto Ricans living on the mainland here? Because they're also agonizing over what's happening to their home territory.
Yeah, you know, I just told them in case they can't get a hold of their relatives, just try to be as calm as you can. If you can't get a hold of your relative, it's fine. Most of us can't either inside the island.
Yeah. Look, we mentioned the 100% of the electrical grid is out. Probably some thinking down the road as to how to rebuild that so it's not as vulnerable. Cell phone towers toppled. There's also flooding. You're just getting out. But are you thinking at all about food? I mean, you're there at the university, but are you worried about runs on stores? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a few days ago I thought, you know, I'm okay. You know, I bought food to be a couple of days here in the radio station. But then I, you know, reality came back to me. And I'm like, oh, my God, this won't be enough in a few days. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to, at least with my coworkers, eat in portions. But eventually we'll have to go outside and see which stores are open and if they're selling food. But I believe food at least is not a main concern, or water. The main concern is the power outage, because some people need electricity because they're, I don't know, tied to a bed, they're sick and need electricity, mm-hmm. or they need to be in a hospital. So to me, electricity, it's practically what's really important.
Right. I mean,
for those sick and
dialysis, oxygen.
Yeah, that type of stuff, yeah.
A lot to think about. How old are you, Miguel?
I'm 21 years old.
You're 21. I didn't realize that.
Is it the voice, maybe?
No.
I get that a lot.
You're not the first very young broadcaster we've talked to going through your first hurricane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It feels like it's a different reality.
Yeah. Look, Miguel Santiago of the public radio station Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico, you take care and stay in touch, okay?
Of course. Anything else you need, you can just, you know, you call me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.